I'm Laura Vinroot Poole of Capital, and this is What We Wore. I'm excited for you to listen to this special live episode of What We Wore, recorded at the Brentwood Country Mart. This conversation features two of our previous guests, Anya Heinmarch and Greg Renfrew of Beauty Counter, and was moderated by our dear friend and transformational leadership coach, Ashley Wick.
Welcome to this very special live episode of Laura Vinroot Poole's podcast, What We Wore. Yes. My name is Ashley Wick, and I am a transformational leadership coach, but this evening I get to be your guest host. And Laura, I really appreciate you handing over the reins,
I'm thrilled.
Trusting me.
Anytime.
I'm looking forward to hearing more of your wisdom tonight.
I'm looking forward to hearing more of your wisdom and their wisdom.
And also being with both of you powerhouses. It's such a pleasure. And being in one of, I think, all of our favorite places in LA, the Brentwood Country Mart. So for those of you, I think everyone here knows these fabulous ladies, but in case you're new to the podcast, Laura Vinroot Poole is the founder of the store Capital, which has a door here in the Mart and also in her hometown of Charlotte, North Carolina. Yes. It is one of the most successful stores in the world, I might add. That's because for Laura, it's never been just about the clothes. It's been about people, which is why you also created this podcast. In today's episode, we're joined by Greg Renfrew and Anya Heinmarch. It's very exciting. Yes. They don't need introduction, but I will anyway. Anya Heinmarch is the creative director and founder of her namesake accessories brand. And she's also a mother of five and the author of her new book, which is called When in Doubt, Wash Your Hair, a brilliant title, a Sunday Times bestseller. And she's also one of the most thoughtful and organized people I know. And Greg is a mother, activist, and a serial entrepreneur, so inspiring, and the founder of Beauty Counter, a clean beauty brand revolutionizing the cosmetics industry. So thank you for being here, all of you. This is really a full circle moment for me as I've had the great privilege of working with both Anya and Laura over the years. And you both have impacted my life immeasurably. And I'm so thankful for your version of feminine leadership and excited to interview all three of you today. So thank you all for being here. One of the things that I find interesting about all three of you is that you forewent college or started businesses very soon after going to college. And I'm just curious to know when you first became aware of your own ambition or maybe a value around hard work and commitment. And Anya, maybe I will start with you.
Well, I think, well, first of all, thank you for that lovely introduction. Can you imagine when she walked in for an interview, this one, like Amazonian, beautiful, sort of Cali girl. I'm like, you're hired. but actually deep-hearted, clever, deep-thinking, gorgeous, gorgeous girl. I was so lucky to work with you, so thank you. So it's funny, isn't it? I think I skipped university because there weren't many offers, truthfully, and I think that's often quite typical of entrepreneurs. You get, shall we say, impatient in the classroom, and straight failed most of it. Yeah, exactly, failed most of it.
Very British way of saying that.
And probably a little bit dyslexic, which I now see as a badge of honour, of course. And I think there was a moment in the UK when it was sort of Thatcher's Britain, and it was like, you can get out there and do anything. I come from a family of business people, more than design people. And so there was that lovely moment of kind of get going. And my mother gave me a handbag when I was 16. I remember how it made me feel. And I think to your point about fashion, it's about people, it's about feeling. And in a funny way, it's of empowerment, actually, and confidence. So that's what inspired me.
And Greg, I think you started your first business, cleaning business, at the age of 19.
Long story, but I think part of it started for me when I was younger. We had some financial insecurity in my family. My father had made some poor choices in his career and then got really sick. And so my mother was kind of often struggling to make ends meet and did an incredible job, you know, buying and selling in real estate and getting my brother and myself through supporting school and college, et cetera. But the cleaning company came because I wanted to go on something called Semester at Sea, which some of you may have, best few months of my life still. Definitively. I just had this on a podcast recently. And but anyway, so it cost a lot more than my University of Vermont education. And my mom said, I'll pay for your, you know, whatever it was, the $10,000 it was for the semester, but you need to make up the rest. And so I went to Nantucket that summer and started a cleaning company with my friends. And we somehow figured out that we could charge people $20 an hour and pay all of our friends $10 an hour. And I walked off the island with more money than I have today, just stuck with cleaning. So that's sort of how it all began for me. And it got me on Semester at Sea, which was a life-changing semester for me.
Sounds like good motivation. Yeah. And Laura, what about you? Was it nature or nurture for you?
Well, definitely have amazing parents, but I don't think that much was expected of me. I mean, I don't think that I was raised to think that I could have a career. I never saw women that worked, to be honest. And so I think I had no idea. And when I started, I really loved it. And I was sort of an animal. I mean, I started at 25 and I've been doing it for 27 years and I love it. I don't want to do anything else. But it wasn't from, you know, I didn't have any expanders. I didn't have anybody showing me how this could be done.
So what made you think you could do it?
Being 25.
Reinvention comes up as a theme when I think of all three of your careers. And I think it's one of those things that's inevitable when you've been in business for longer than 25 or 30 years. And it also requires stepping way out of our comfort zones. Can you share a time when you had to reinvent yourself or your business model, and what lessons you learned from that experience? And Greg, looks like
Greg, you can start.
You're going first.
Oh my God, are you kidding me?
We might be here all night.
In case you guys didn't see it in the press. this is sort of funny. So I came in here crying my eyes out. Some of you probably saw me in the parking lot sobbing because I'm kind of having one of those days because I just bought my company Beauty Counter back out of foreclosure, having sold it for $1 billion to the Carlyle Group. Woo! 3 years ago. So yeah. And maybe through a series of bad decisions, I am now forced to reinvent my company from scratch. So
in 2 weeks.
It's a little scary. In 2 weeks, yes. So I think that, you know, Anya said to me, we've been friends for a very, very long time. And, you know, she said to me, you know, you've got this. And, you know, you asked when did you feel you had it? I think that you reinvent oftentimes. Well, I think entrepreneurs often are visionaries, like, and I don't mean that in like an arrogant way. They just see, they imagine the possibility of something that others might not yet be able to see. And they're stupid enough more times than not to like actually think that they can do it. And they just kind of go do it. And, you know, Anya was giving me a pep talk because I literally was having a moment. And Megan, with whom I worked for many years, happened to see me. And she's like, are you crying? I'm like, maybe.
No.
Sorry, I'm transparent. It's honest. But I think that sometimes you just you're scared to death, but you have to walk through the door. And when you do that, things happen and you begin to evolve and things change. And you realize that There is a brighter future, and sometimes it's not exactly as you're anticipating it. But sometimes those challenging moments when you're forced to reinvent are the moments that give you the knowledge and the vision that things can be different and better. And I guess I am admittedly really in one of those very scary moments in my life. So if you guys all want to buy some vitamin C serum in a couple of weeks when I relaunch my site. But it is part of the process. It's just part of the process. And it happens in relationships and in life, but certainly in business.
You've got this. I have no doubt at all. We're going to be laughing about this.
This moment is your support squad right here. Greg, on that note, when fear bubbles up for you in this moment, because it's so raw, what is one thing that you do to manage it?
Actually, I'll take my glasses off because I have been crying. I think that, I think at the end of the day, like being really honest and transparent and vulnerable, allowing it out. Like, I think that we've, especially as women, they're mostly women here. I feel like we're often taught that you have to show strength all the time. And a lot of people that know me think I'm like super strong and direct, and I am. But I'm also really vulnerable and sensitive. And I think for me, when I feel scared,
I just have to like take a deep breath. I've got a lot of like songs that I listen to. Like everyone that knows me well knows I'm like an Eminem like addict. You know, if you had one shot, one opportunity, that's my song. I was like, but you got to just like, I just like sort of try to take a deep breath. And I like try to walk through that door. And I lean shamelessly on women around me and men who believe in me. And those that are going to amplify me and let me and like catch me when I fall, which I do often. But I think it's just knowing you're scared, taking a deep breath, resetting, and sort of somehow pumping yourself up because you do know that you can do this. You can always do it. You said this. You can do. We can all do hard things all the time. We do. All of you do hard things every single day of your lives. And so it's just knowing something's going to be hard and still taking that step through the door that you're scared of.
Your life is certainly proof that you can do hard things, all three of you. Yeah. Reinvention for you, Laura.
You know, going through something like 2008, and we almost went out of business, and I think I didn't know whether I was a fighter or a flighter, and I was very clearly a fighter. I mean, there was no question that I was never gonna give up, you know. And I had several CFOs tell me I should give up and just turn the keys in. And I just, that wasn't okay for me. It was not a possibility. So I don't think you know till you know almost.
Right when you're on the precipice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so after 2008, like the pandemic, people were like, oh my God, freaking out. What are you going to do? Like, who cares? Like, whatever. This is nothing. You know, after 2008 to 2012.
And Anya, I know that that was a tough time when we were working together in 2008 too.
It wasn't me. No, it's a funny thing. I think your point about as you get older, actually, you realize that you will find a solution to it. And actually, mostly, if you've done it once before, you can do it again. Actually, I think you learn that you'll find the right solution. It's when it's all a bit of a sort of bit of knotted string. At that point, that's the scary bit. But someone once told me that fear and excitement are the same emotion. And actually, it's really important to reframe fear as excitement, actually. And when you kind of, that's really helped me in my difficult moments of thinking I'm really bloody scared. But actually, it's so exciting because, you know, what's the worst that can go wrong, you know? You're not going to die. You know, it's something, you know, might be a bit humiliating, but actually mostly if you can do it once, you'll do it again. I think
we call that following the fear to the end in our coaching business.
Depends what the end is.
All the way to the end. But usually it feels catastrophic in our minds. And once we play it out and talk it out, it's actually quite humorous what we think might happen.
I often think if you write down what's the worst that can happen here, actually. And then if you face that, then it's only, you know, and you find, it's just like snakes and ladders. You find your way through the kind of, you know, up, down, back a bit, and then up a ladder and so on. And I definitely had, when I bought my business back, it was a sort of a scary moment for me thinking, can I do it again? And what am I taking on? Where are the bodies buried? Will I get the team back? And actually, it's been incredibly exciting. It's all about good people. We know that more than anything. I always think the word company is lovely. It's the company of people you keep. And, you know, I keep very good company and I can handpick the people I work with. And so you find your way through. And I think, you know, you might make the wrong decision, but then you sort of readjust and you've got to dance on your toes and work very, very hard, by the way. That's fair, isn't it? We work very, very hard. So I try and see the fear as excitement.
I've also heard that fear and desire are two sides of the same coin. And so when we can focus on the desire rather than the fear, that can help change our perspective.
It's rather confusing. You American girls, honestly.
California.
I'm going to pretend not to be offended. Anya. How has your definition of success changed over the years?
Well, I mean, I think success is, you know, are you really happy? And it's funny, often things that you think make you happy are not the things that make you happy. For me, it's sitting around my kitchen table with a pretty funny old sort of roast chicken and, you know, people I love and not looking particularly tidy and, you know, having good chats. That's, for me, richer than anything in the whole world. And so I think, you know, you learn actually what really makes you happy, as opposed to what you think makes you happy. And that's a golden moment, I think.
Greg, what about for you?
I think that I for sure define success. I think the scorecard for me, certainly in the business world, was monetary success, because the scorecard has always been about money, right? How big was the company? How much money did they make? Right? We all know this. now to me, success is defined by impact. And, you know, when I think about the success of my life, I've said oftentimes, Megan's heard me say this 1,000 times, that when I turned 40 and I thought, if I died today, would I have done all I could do on this earth? Would I have given as much as I could? Could I have had as much impact? And that was, you know, a number of years ago. And so when I think about the success of my life, did I love enough, hard enough? Did I lift enough others, especially women? Did I lift enough women up? Did I help enough people? Did I change the world enough? Like, with the gifts that I've been given, with the time I have on this earth, like, successful for me will be on my last moment of life, like, that I feel like I did as much as I could, and then I'm proud of the relationships I've enjoyed and the people I've impacted. I think it's the money is just one of those things that you think when you're younger it's going to make a difference in your life, and then if you make it, you realize you feel nothing towards the money. It's all about, like, did I actually make a difference in someone else's life? At least for me, that's how I felt. You know, and which is why we all work so hard, because I promise you that the four women sitting up here right now, and many of you in this room, so to speak, are not in it for the money. We may need to earn money. We have to earn money to pay our bills, but it's not what drives us as people, and it's not what makes us happy.
Beautifully said. But Laura, in the context of Southern culture, capital has played a really important role in empowering women to have careers. Will you just talk a little bit about that?
I started to realize that I would lose these wonderful women when they got married. It was not a question. Like, when they got married, they retired. And I thought that was so weird. And then I would get interns that were not up to the task, didn't know how to make a phone call or write an email. And we really decided to change our culture. And to when these young women that were 17, 18 years old, when they left us, they were adult women that were professional and able to be professional. We have leadership coaching for all of them. We have maternity leave coaching. But it's a really hard battle to fight, especially in the South, because it's just part of the culture. It has been. I think it's changing a lot, but it was just so strange. You would have this incredible person that was, and I have one of my earliest employees here who started when she was 16. And then they were just gone. They were like, all right, it's over. Like, my career is over. And that's not okay for me. I mean, it's okay. But I think you should have the option to have a fulfilling career and a family if that's what you want.
Anya, what assumptions have you challenged or things that you might have taken for granted that you now know to be different or true for you?
I think it's really important to realize that you can drive a successful business and be kind. Actually, I think that's key. I think, and as a woman, that you don't have to be sort of, you know, really tough and act like a man. And I really love the fact that I think the culture that we have, and many of my friends' companies have, and you sort of see more and more, that you can have a kind culture that can also be really successful and that's respectful. That's a really exciting thing. And I think that's becoming the norm, which is great.
I think that's so true for you. I can attest to that culture. Yeah, especially in a fashion industry that there's so much pressure to be cool and look a certain way, that being nice isn't always actually the easiest route, or governing by fear was back in the day. It feels like more of the way that businesses were run than they are today. And the two of you have certainly trailblazed in that way. And I think that's one of your defining
features. You have to have an expander. You have to have that one person that shows you that. And I think, you know, you're definitely one of those people that shows you how it can be done differently.
I think it's also viral behavior, isn't it? So if you behave a certain way and you know, you're respectful and you're kind, then people carry on that behavior. And, you know, it just hopefully, as you say, expand is a nice word, but it's a privilege to run a company and to be able to do it in the way that you want with the people that you want. For me, I get such a kick out of being in a room with people I really love with a sort of tough agenda and, you know, ticking off that to-do list and making it happen. That's really exciting. And I think sharing that really openly, that challenge and working through it is, you know, it's great. You feel amazing at the end of that. And we laugh and, you know, ring the bell when it goes well and bring out the box of tissues when it goes badly. But, you know, it's an amazing journey and a privilege, frankly.
For some of the women out here that might be building businesses, culture is so important, as we're talking about. What are some of the ways that you've built a positive culture or inclusive culture, or however you would define Anya's culture?
Well, I think brand is a very overused word, and I think it should be replaced by the word behavior. And I think that real experience of a brand is through a patchwork of zillions of different bits of experience of a company or a management or a style or a culture. And so it has to be real and authentic. And I think it's that tiny thing that it's a kind word when someone's had a tough time or helping someone out, you know, doing the real things. Those sort of hard yards are actually what matters. And that's a genuine culture, not just a strap line. I think it's the important thing.
Greg, what about you?
I'm not as nice as you two. I'm not sure everyone will be like, Greg is the kindest leader ever. They might say some other things. Oh, no, I mean, I'm a nice person, but I'm not as nice as they are. I think that it doesn't matter what business you're in, you're only ever going to be in one business, and that's in the business of people. Doesn't matter what you're selling, you're in finance, you're in fashion, you're in beauty, real estate, you're in the business of people. And managing people and leading people, inspiring people, being open and honest and vulnerable with people is, I think, really important because they all have hopes and dreams and breakups with boyfriends and family members that are ill and financial struggles and fertility struggles and they didn't get the raise they wanted or they're too scared to ask for it. There's so much that goes into business that has literally nothing to do with the product that you sell or make. And so I think what I've learned over time is to let go a little bit of trying to, like, it wasn't that I was trying to act like a man, but even when I moved out here, I, you know, came out of New York and came on really strong. I do come on really strong. Sorry. I know. You guys
That's
know.
What we love about
I'm
you.
I'm looking at my friends over there on the right. They're like, uh-huh. But I think that, like, what I've learned is that you can be strong and confident, but also vulnerable and kind, that you don't always, I do think there are a lot of women that walk around like men in skirts and they feel like they have to present perfect. It's like most people wouldn't admit that they were crying on the way into a panel. And I could get on a beauty panel and admit that I wasn't passionate about beauty products. I started Beauty Counter because I wanted people to be healthy because so many people were getting sick. There was no such thing as clean beauty. Like, I think it's just being able to be open and honest and to lift women up and show other women. So if there are other women in here who are younger and building their businesses and their careers, to say you actually can have a career and be a great wife and be a great mother. And maybe you can't be perfect at it all every day. And yeah, maybe one day you did forget to put the thing in the lunchbox, or you're going to have a huge fight with your husband or your partner, but showing the real side of life, but showing you can also be successful and helping people realize that they have potential and you see that in them.
I think having that kind of self-awareness is so important to understand what role you should have in your company or even what work you should pursue. I call that genius. And Laura, I'm curious to know if you were to define your genius, what that might be. Like, what are you uniquely suited to do?
I think, like Greg said, open secret, I don't know that I love fashion that much. I really love, I'm sorry, but I do. I love beautiful things, but I really love making people feel confident and beautiful and, you know, like themselves. So I think that's my magic. That's what I do. That's what I love the most.
You're so good at it. So good at it.
Thank you.
And Anya, what about you? You have this like magical mix of right and left brain power.
I love creativity. I mean, I love people. I really love sitting in my meetings. We have a sort of a town hall every week and sort of going through what we're doing and how we've done and actually, you know, engaging everyone and hearing what's going on. I really love that. So people are my favorite thing, and leading a team. And I love often doing that in a creative way. I think creativity it's just such a privilege to work in creative businesses. And sometimes it just feels like I'm sort of playing, actually. And you have mad ideas that have nothing to do with the business at all. I had an obsession.
Like what?
Well, I had an obsession with male voice Welsh choirs. That's quite niche when I'm in LA. You know. That's not rude. That's not the desire chat, by the way. That's literally, it's a type of choir. And I also had an obsession with having a sleepover in the bed department of Peter Jones, which is a department store, which I also achieved. So you have to find ways around these things from a business purpose.
As you're scaling a business, it's impossible to try to control everything and wear all the hats that you once wore when you started the business. And I can imagine it would be a real challenge to try to control all of that, controlling your brand name, controlling people, controlling your voice on social media, your image. How do you navigate that? Anya, we'll start with you.
I think you have to stop caring, actually. It's very important, funnily enough, because you can only be who you are. And I don't think it actually resonates until you actually just forget it all and just do what you do. And any time I've ever done a project where I've just really been passionate about what I'm doing and you just park everything else in your brain, it's probably been the most successful project. And whether that's I'm a Plastic Bag or Return to Nature or Flying Hearts over Hong Kong or London or whatever the mad project might be, I think you just have to stop worrying what people think. And it's a lovely thing that comes with age, actually. I think you turn 50 and you're like, I don't care anymore. And actually, I'm just going to do what I do. And it's a really good moment. So that helps.
Because the name of your book is When in Doubt, ... What is one way that you manage your self-doubt or have successfully?
Rather ashamed I actually didn't wash my hair this morning. I was a bit jet-lagged. But I think it's girlfriends. Genuinely, I feel so privileged to have an amazing group of women that surround me and who I can be very vulnerable with. And I think being vulnerable, to your earlier point, is really important. And actually, a lovely, quite recent sort of, I think you now can be vulnerable. I think that was something. And actually, the book I wrote was actually just saying that, you know, I really suffered out. We all do. Everyone does. That's okay. And in fact, it's a strength. It's there on your shoulder, keeping you safe. You can turn the volume down, but it's actually there to keep you safe.
Laura, you know, in the face of illness and becoming a mother and all perimenopause and all the things that women face.
I've had them all.
What motivates you to keep going?
I think my team and my clients. I mean, I think I love what I do. But back to the earlier question, I think it's also, I think the most important thing is building a team out that is better at everything than you are. I've always done that. My mom died a few weeks ago, and we were with her kind of for a couple of weeks leading up to it. My dad kept on saying, don't you think you should go into the store and check in on everybody? And I said, if in 27 years I haven't built something that runs for 2 weeks while my mom dies, you know, on its own, then it's not a business. So I think I've always done that. I've always hired the very best salespeople and just the best team, and everybody's better at all the things than I am.
Greg, you have so much going on, especially right now in these 2 weeks of real reinvention. How do you reconcile it all? How do you manage showing up for your kids, who I think are now teenagers? How do you do it? How do you stay steady?
You know, one of my dear friends said, you know, outsource like the administrative side of things and be present for the things that matter. Like, don't drive and spend the hour driving to Target to get the construction paper. Order that online or have someone else pick it up for you so that you can actually do the project with your kids. We're super close family. And I think a number of years ago, to the detriment of my social life in LA, which was new, and it's been a hard place for me to live because I moved out here older and having been, you know, really established in New York and then starting Beauty Counter and having three small children and trying to navigate things, like I really prioritized my family and my work. I don't know. I think it's like the little things. Like I've always said to people, and Megan knows this because she worked with me for 9 years. I said 8 earlier. She reminded me it was 9. But, you know, if anyone knows me that works with me knows that I will always, every single time, pick up the phone if my children call. Every single time. And I don't care if I was sitting with the President of the United States, which I wasn't. But if I were, no matter how important the meeting is, I always say, I'm sorry. This is something that I'm not even sorry. I pick up the phone for my children. So I think it's finding that in those moments where you're really crazed is, I, you know, and some of me people went to Canyon Elementary with school with me and my kids, and I would say things like, when they'd say, let's meet for coffee after drop off, I got comfortable saying, like, that's never, it's not going to ever happen. And it's not because I don't think you're a nice person. I just can't handle it all right now. So all I can focus on is my children and my husband and my kids. And if my social life worked with that, then that was great. Otherwise, I probably didn't see people very much. I think I took life down a notch because I don't think you can do it all at the same time. And there are going to be moments in my life where I can be really social again. And there are moments when you just have to focus on family or your children. You all are doing that every day. And I think if you try to do everything perfectly at every moment of the life, you're just going to be frazzled constantly. But if you give yourself permission to say, at this moment, I'm going to focus on these things that matter at this moment, because life hopefully is long, then you can stay kind of somewhat balanced.
Taking that long view. Yeah.
Yeah. And I take a bath every single night. Sorry, I'm in California. I know. And that like calms me down every single night. Even when I'm overserved. I need to like get in the bath and then read a few pages of a book so I can calm down.
Anya, you have you had a brilliant Christmas time family hack with your children. I think in a moment of overwhelm, with all five children. Would you share that hack?
So it sounds really mean, doesn't it? But it's just being practical. I think the overarching, I'm going to frame it so it doesn't sound like I'm a terrible mother, which I am mostly. Terrible mother to five poor children.
Not true.
But you actually have to be kind to yourself as well and be realistic about what you can manage. And I know that my social batteries are not great. And I think you really do need to be, you know, quite sensible. You need to actually put in little stepping stones into your diary to give yourself breaks. And be as kind to yourself as you would to a colleague. And that's something that often makes me stop and think that actually that's quite important as well. I think it's really important to sort of share with your kids that you're in a state of overwhelm. They actually understand and they're really kind when you do. And when you're in a state of overwhelm at Christmas, having framed that a bit, you see where I've gone there, I realized that shopping for five children, trying to get the equal amount of excitement and the equal sort of, you know, parity in terms of generosity was quite tricky actually. And so, you know, a box of Lego was super exciting for one child, and the other one wanted, you know, probably, I don't know, an incredibly expensive laptop or something, and trying to kind of get it all right. And in the end, we actually came up with a system, so it's just a hack, which we called the Christmas contract. Obviously, we're in business. And when the children got a certain age, not when they were little, but we thought quite a funny contract, which was saying we put the same amount of money into each of their bank accounts on the 1st of December. They had to spend it in full, and there were a whole list of terms and conditions. They didn't spend it would go to this year a donkey sanctuary, or it might be a, you know, some other lovely charity, and they would essentially have the most wonderful time buying their own Christmas presents. And they spent hours getting the right deal or buying the right lens for their camera. They had to give the presents to us before Christmas, not open them, and feign huge surprise on Christmas morning. And we still do it to this day, and they're now 35. They're like, we got the Christmas contract, you know. So the point is, it's actually basically saying, do your own Christmas shopping, actually. But the fact is, they loved it. It worked for us. It meant that we didn't have a million unnecessary presents. And so you have to find your way through in a sensible way.
Beautiful. Laura, how has mothership influenced your approach to work?
I only have one, and that's a lot. I think having grown up in a place where I didn't see women working, it was really important for me to show her what that looked like and that it made me really happy. And even in those times when, you know, I felt desperate and I was in Antwerp in the rain and miserable, I was like, I'm doing this. But yeah, I think that. And she did say something when we dropped off at college. She said, you weren't there that much. But she said, I'm really proud of you. And I'm really, you know, I learned so much from watching this.
You know, I used to say to my kids, like, mom has three jobs. First and foremost, I'm your mom. Second, I'm daddy's wife. And third, I'm the CEO of Beauty Counter. And I love all three. And I'm good at all three. And I really care about you. And not apologizing. Like, even if you do need to work because you need to earn an income, not telling them that. Just say, actually, I do it because I love it. And it's important to me. And it's a part of me. And I hope you can understand that why I might not always be a pickup, or, you know, I wasn't always around either. But again, trying to be there for the important moments, that I'm doing something that I'm good at, that I care about, that brings me joy. And actually, when they do get older, even though they may miss you in the moment, they are really proud. And you've shown them through example that you can, that they can be totally loved. And also, you're also pursuing something that is important to you. And I think oftentimes, as women, we're asked to choose. You can either be a great spouse and mother, or you can be a career person. And I think that every choice that a woman makes in terms of how they raise their family is the right choice for their family. And it's also okay to do both. You know, it's okay. It doesn't have to be an either or.
Interesting. My mother-in-law gave me one bit of advice, which is amazing. She said, if you are happy, your children will be happy. And I thought that was a very generous thing to say, actually, and I think it's true.
Okay, we're going to switch gears a little bit. It's such a turbulent retail climate right now and has changed so much over the last 10 years. Anya, I'm curious to know, we were talking about this earlier, what you're most excited about or worried about.
Well, I think that when there's times of change, it's actually hugely exciting. And I know the fear and excitement thing I said earlier, but genuinely, I think that's when sort of bits of magic happen. And it's very easy to sit on the Titanic and play the violin and think it's all going to be the same. But actually, when you have something as exciting as the internet coming into the world and actually changing the way people interact with product and decisions, there's all sorts of opportunities. And so you have to be quite bold, I think, and lean into change and not be scared and try things and just follow your gut. So I think it's an interesting moment. I think ultimately there's going to be a lot of challenges with wholesale, the wholesale business, unless you run it as beautifully as you do, where you know your customers. And I'm afraid there's an awful lot of wholesale business that doesn't do that, so it's not so healthy. And then you get into that spiral at the moment where you can see all these wholesale customers that they're all discounting, and it's all kind of quite frantic. But ultimately, if you make a beautiful product and you have a lovely customer who likes your product, there's a future. And it's sort of navigating and finding the right way to that and not being sort of scared to try different things. So I've always quite liked the uncomfortable. That's actually kind of a happy place for me, which is kind of uncomfortable in itself, but it's where I sit. So I think it's a time to experiment and see and just to kind of really get to know your customer and feels, you know, work out what feels right.
Laura, could you answer that question too? Like, how have things changed the retail environment? You've had to pivot. You invented House Account, which was a mobile shopping app.
Yeah, that crashed and burned. I mean, I was talking to somebody about it today. You know, Farfetch tried to buy it twice, and it ended up just blowing up, and, you know, we lost everything. But I have zero regrets. I mean, it was such an incredible experience to do something completely different that I knew nothing about, and to learn about it and to build a team around it. I think all experience is good experience. I always told Fifi, my daughter, that even bad boyfriends are good because you see what you don't want, you know? So I think all experience is helpful if you learn from it.
Well, and Greg, I think that retail store that you created that had the virtual streaming opportunity in the back was genius. And as you think about what's next for Beauty Counter, you may not even be there yet, but do you have a vision for what the actual brick and mortar presence will look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think that currently Beauty Counter is in like 580 Ulta locations. So there is their retail presence, and then there's the independent stores that we have. But I'm very much a believer, and I have been for a while, that your community is your client. Your client is your community. Community-based commerce is kind of the way of the future, meaning that there are communities that surround brands that are passionate about the brands and what the core tenets of those brands are. And I think that one of the things when I sold the business, it was going really, really well. And it was towards the end of the pandemic. And what I think one of the things that was challenging about the business over the last number of years, and we're going to hopefully start to get this back on track, is that people want physical interaction. So they like the convenience of online shopping. So they're transactional in those moments. And certainly from a replenishment standpoint or a browsing standpoint, online is a really important part of any, you know, consumer-facing business today. And people really love the opportunity to be, this is why the Brentwood Country Mart is such an amazing place. Really, it doesn't honestly, yes, the brands here are great, but it's about community. This place is emblematic of what's happening in retail today, which is you have high quality product that is built on community. The business, you know, everyone comes here. The most powerful people in the world come here every single day because there's a community aspect to the Brentwood Country Mart. And I think about, so good job, Jim, honestly. So it's, I think to me, it's that people do want an opportunity. And so when I think about Beauty Counters, you know, I think futuristically, if I can just get through this week, is that I think that we need to have more shops and maybe in less obvious places because everyone's so obsessed with the coasts. And maybe you need to be in smaller cities where you become important and you become a gathering spot for the community that supports your brand, complemented by your online presence so that your customer is able to move seamlessly through channels to get what they want when they want, which they need. But I think there's something powerful about that right now, about being able, which is what you've done so brilliantly in London. If you guys haven't been to, you know, she can call it Anya's Village. I would just call it Anya's World. It's like the entire city of London is now dedicated to Ms. Hindmarch over here. She has like a whole, like she has like her own Brentwood Country Mart, just happened to be called Anya, with like every shop you can imagine on like a couple blocks. But it's like there's a community that goes in and out of these shops, and I've watched it. I'm one of those people. And it's the same thing here. It's the same thing when I walk into your shop, and I have in Charlotte too. You know, everyone's talking, and there's a community aspect of it, and people want to gather. And so retail is important. That's never going to go away.
I was astounded when, Laura, you told me that you knew your customers so well that nearly 50% of the inventory was sold before it even hit the floor. It's impressive.
Yeah, I mean, every order has names by every single thing we pull. And because we know so-and-so's daughter's getting married and she just got divorced and she's going to have to be with a new wife. And, she, you know, like, we know what, you know what I mean? Just all the
intimate details.
All, yeah, yeah. I mean, we, that's our job, I think, is to help people manage those things.
Anya, what's next at the Village? What's coming up? Are you allowed to share?
Yes, if I'd have to kill you, obviously, but it should be a great show. No, we've actually, the next, it's currently a summer shop, which is really lovely. It's like a really old-fashioned, the sort of tourist shop you might find on holidays. It's kind of really lots of weird little funny things. And then we move back into ice cream, which is, we have these, we have these very unusual flavors of ice cream. So things like baked beans and Liam Perrin sauce and soy sauce, kikam and so on. And they're all made, homemade in this amazing local place. And so, yeah, it's a bit mad. So that's next.
I want to talk about style. I would love to know a way that fashion or beauty has influenced who you are and how you show up. Because your passion for clothing reaches far beyond the clothes themselves. But how has fashion influenced who you are and how you show up? I know, Laura, you once said.
I was just going to say, I think that people can, you can say it's trite, but I think that fashion is the first communication. I mean, it's the first thing that you tell the world about who you are and where you've been and what you think. And so it is something to think about because it's a silent communication that you're giving to everyone. So I think it's important.
Greg, what about you?
Well, I think it is part of your personal brand. And as I've gotten older, I've gotten more and more comfortable in my own personal style. I mean, for me, and Lauren knows this because I am one of those customers that calls her and tells her everything I'm doing. And then what's shoes and what was my daughter wear? So you do have an intimate relationship with it, which I think is important. And I think for me as a woman, and I think this is true of many people, certainly many women, is that when I feel like I have the right outfit on, dressy, casual, whatever, I exude confidence. And when I feel underdressed or overdressed, and I've gotten better. And one of the things I think that I would encourage younger people to do is to know your style and be like, everybody in LA was all into these like maxi dresses. And it's just like not my look. I don't look good in them. Like they're terrible on me. And you know, I went to a lunch, actually, Brooke, you were there. And there were like two women out of like 50 in pants. And I was one of them. And like, I know my style and I feel much more confident when I'm, and so if I'm going into an important meeting, if I'm nervous about something, like, you know, I focus on a few key pieces of clothing that I know I'll always feel confident in. And I think for beauty, it's the same thing. Like if you are in the mood to feel sexy, you're going to put on one type of look, or create one like type of look. And when you want to just look innocent, you're going to look differently. And I do think that beauty and fashion play nicely off of one another, where you can really, it really can help you create the mood or project what you want to feel in that moment in time.
I think, Anya, you mentioned that fashion is almost a psychological tool in that same vein. What is your version of second skin? What makes you feel, what are you wearing when you feel most comfortable?
I think it's when I don't think about it, honestly. I think it is without a doubt, you are judged by how you look. I mean, I think that's just inevitable. But when you walk into a room and you feel good, it's all about confidence. And I think everyone strives for, you know, wealth and the right look, and actually it's just, we want you to strive for being confident. That's the only thing that really matters. And I think what's interesting about fashion is how it makes you feel, but also actually when you're creating fashion, the whole point of it is actually you're almost saying this is different and persuading people to then take that path, whether it's buy that thing or take that look or whatever it might be. And in a way, confidence drives that as well. So I think confidence is the aim, but also with selling things, it's about being confident about something a bit different and pulling that off. It's very interesting. Confidence is a very fragile and fascinating subject, I think, but it's the ultimate aim, really.
We didn't talk about sustainability, and I'm curious to know what endeavors you're pursuing now on that front. Besides that bag, obviously.
I mean, I spent most of my career actually working on trying to avoid landfill, and then more recently on this bag that then could never end up in landfill, but more recently a project with supermarkets on trying to address the problem of bags for life. Do you have bags for life here? Which is, you know, what you're meant to take a slightly sort of heavier bag. Apparently, I think that the average usage is about 2 weeks, and they mainly end up in hedgerows or under your sink. So we've worked on a project called Universal Bag, which we're actually about to launch in the States, which is the best next version of that, which I'm very proud of. I won't go into too much detail now, but it's kind of quite cool. So yeah, watch this space.
Very exciting. And Greg, what about you?
Well, Beauty Counter, our entire business has been to protect the health and safety of people and subsequently the earth. So, you know, in terms of what's next, I mean, I think that we have always been, you know, we've moved completely away from virgin plastic. We have been, over the last year or two, they've made sure that 107 of our SKUs are using responsibly sourced palm oil. We, as a company, have always tried to get to the root of the issue and try to create systemic change, including things like going to all the mines that we use for mica throughout the world and actually physically auditing them, which was the first company to do that in 40 years, and realizing that, you know, children were in these mines. And instead of hiding behind that and moving to synthetic fragrance, we actually tackled it with nonprofit organizations on the ground and created a little mini documentary out of that and showed the world like our journey. And so I think for us, sustainability is about, you know, protecting the health of the earth and making sure that you're good to the earth through sustainable packaging and your carbon footprint, et cetera. And it's also, to me, sustainability is also looking at the people who harvest the crops, the people that are working in the fields. Are they treated fairly? Are they, and as women, in danger when they're actually harvesting a crop and working in this field? So to me, it's like a holistic approach that's been at the core of the company since the beginning and will continue to be an important part of who we are, because I think we owe it to future generations to take care of the earth upon which we all live.
Beautifully said.
I'll just say, I think just make sure that everything that you consume, from clothing to beauty to food, everything that you consume should be, that the person who made it should be paid a living wage.
100%.
Yeah. That's an easy way to, I mean, I think that's the easiest way to say sustainability for me, and to remember it every day, all day. Why is it so expensive? Because somebody hand embroidered it for 47 hours.
So keep it for a long time. So typically we end each episode of What We Wore with a question about what you wore to prom, which both of you have answered on the podcast already. So I encourage all of you to find out what each of them wore to prom by going to Spotify and listening in. But today we're going to ask a different question, which is, what was the most memorable fashion moment that you've had in the last 5 years? And Laura, we'll start with you.
It sounds crazy, but it's opening the store here. I mean, we opened it 5 years ago, and this has always been my favorite shopping center in the entire world. And the minute I landed in LA, this was the first place I came. And it was this. I mean, this was a dream. And when Jim invited us to do this, I could hardly believe it. And it's spectacular.
Well, I'll tell one because you were there. I bought a red dress that I didn't buy at Capital, but it's a brand that I've bought at Capital, Bernadette, which I discovered at Capital. And I went to a wedding that Anya and I were both at last summer for her nephew, which was quite the over-the-top amazing wedding. Anyway, I felt really good in this red dress, and then I walked out, and I happened to be standing next to Pippa Middleton, who was also the only other person in the, like, 450 people that were there in a red dress. And I was like, damn, you know. And, of course, the, like, paparazzi, like, going nuts, but not at me, at her, of course. And then later, I don't know why I'm thinking of this, but because you were sitting next to me. But then later, I'm standing there, like, hours later, and someone taps my shoulder, and she said, you're the girl with the red dress. And she's like, I don't really know anyone here. Do you want to hang out with me? And I was like, oh, sure. And we had met for 2 seconds with you at breakfast. Anyway, I guess, I don't know why I thought of this, but just because you're British and sitting next to me, and we were there together. But it was funny how, like, actually, because I was in a red dress, I ended up meeting someone that was interesting for me to meet. So,
also, men love red.
And I love red. And anytime, actually, all joking aside, red, you know, when I got to testify in front of Congress a number of years ago, whenever I've had a really important moment, or when I have done an interview on television, something for Beauty Counter, like, red is definitely my power color. I feel confident in it. And going to a wedding in a different country with people I didn't really know, I wore it. So, yes, it is a good color.
Fashion moment in the last 5 years. I'm still about actually just 3 seconds on a project that I did. So this is a bit me, but it's important. And it's because we worked on a project, which is a bag called Return to Nature, which is a bag that can never end up in landfill. And it was such a passion project. I literally went to the farms, worked for years on how we can make it so it wouldn't actually go wrong. And so therefore it would compost and biodegrade into the soil and support plant healthy soil for plant life. And the very end of this project, having spent 2 years developing it, we put the composted soil that had the leather in it, and we grew plants from it, and the plants grew 20% taller than the soil that didn't have the leather in it. And that was just a really big fashion moment for me. Albeit a weird one, that was a really good one. I cried.
Does that bag still exist?
Yes. Oh yeah, yeah. For sale now.
It's available at Capital. Capital.
Audrey.
Do we have time for 10 minutes of Q&A? So you both sold your businesses, is that correct? And then you bought them back. So did you sell them because they got to a point where you were super successful and you could sell them for a lot of money? And then did you set it up where you were part of that still, like on the board and had some control? And is that why now you, for example, recently rebought your business? I'm just curious how that went.
I'm going to say this carefully, because this could go out to the world. So I sold my company. So when I built Beauty Counter, when I first started, I didn't have all that much money to put into it. And it was incredibly expensive because we created clean beauty and there was no such thing and it cost a lot of money. So I raised a bunch of capital from individuals and then private equity firms. And typically, I'm sure most of you know this, but for those who are listening that don't, you know, when you private equity firms usually have, like, there's a shelf life, like they need to turn a profit within 5 to 7 years because those funds need to keep, you know, replenishing, et cetera. So we had been approached by a large strategic 2 years prior to selling, and it was a really, really high valuation and the investors really wanted me to sell and I wasn't ready yet. And then when we were approached to do this, the second round, I knew that they were going to force me to sell because that's what private equity does. The market was strong. We were booming as a company at the time and we could command $1 billion valuation. And so we went hard at it. The reason that, so that's the first part of it. And that's oftentimes, you know, the case for, and I think that we would all say this, when you bring in outside capital, you need to know that they have an agenda that is not always your agenda, but it's also part of life now because it's really hard to build a business in today's consumer market. It's very different than it used to be where you had a store and then you had a website and then you had a customer service function. Consumers want everything day one and it's expensive to do that. And then the second piece of it, I was hired. I was to be CEO. The intention was for me to be CEO. And unfortunately, the business faltered in the first few months after I sold it. And the company that bought my company decided that I wasn't capable of running the company anymore and brought in a, you know, big gun beauty CEO who unfortunately made some bad decisions along with the owners. And the company had been in decline and was about to fully go kaput. And so I just last week bought it back, which is why I'm crying a lot right now, because our company has a right to win and a reason to exist. And there are 40,000 women that we represent around the United States and Canada. And I just wasn't going to let it go. Woo! Sorry, I'd like to kill the night on that one.
I'm just going to add that I think, interestingly, and this is not for now and everyone's cold, but there probably should be a different way. I've been thinking about this quite a lot because I could write a book about the number of founders, and I'm one of them who ended up nearly losing the company, selling it, and then it going really wrong. And actually, I think the role of a founder in a company is very important. And so there's lots of examples where sort of founders sell out because they obviously want to realize some money, and then they often have some equity left in, and it just goes quite wrong. It might be better to be a slightly sort of softer curve more than this sort of hockey stick, and to keep a role for founders, because actually I think they're quite essential actually in driving businesses. So it's an interesting topic. We should write that book. We'll do that when
it is a book.
Once you've mended your company, we'll do the book. Okay. Should probably stop it then.
And proof that you are the right person for the job.
Yeah. No, it is. And actually, sorry, we should stop it here, but I do think that it's the, I said earlier that this, when you asked what success looked like or what, how we define success, the scorecard in the business world has always been about money. And the reality is it is imperative that we shift that paradigm, that it is about taking care of people and the planet and turning a profit. And there needs to be a better way for venture capital and private equity to put money behind businesses that matter while allowing those that are running those companies to enjoy upside but not be beholden to the confines or the construct of funds. And it's one of the things that I'm incredibly passionate about is figuring out better ways to provide capital, allowing people to earn money because they've taken a chance, but also not ousting founders and early stage leadership teams just because it seems easier to bring in the corporate people when they're just looking at spreadsheets. And so I think if there's an entrepreneur out there, we'd all love to partner with you both on the book and figuring out that business model.
Thank you. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
For sharing your wisdom.
Thank you all for having us.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. Please follow us on Instagram at What We Wore Podcast for additional content and show updates. QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.